Welcome to the Smart Dating Academy podcast. I'm Bella Gandhi, the founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host. I started Smart Dating Academy in 2009 because I had this crazy knack of giving people dating advice that actually worked, that I took. I've been married for almost 25 years, and now my company helps people to date smarter and to find love. This podcast is meant to bring more love into your life, no matter where you are and what you do. And we're here to bring more life into your love. Smart daters, welcome back to this week's episode of the Smart Dating Academy podcast. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. We are so excited to have you here. And I think you're going to be super excited and jumping out of your skin with the conversation that I'm about to have with my new friend, Dr. Jess Carbino. Dr. Jess, welcome to the podcast. And I guess before I welcome you officially, I mean, you have an amazing resume. You've been called the Dr. Ruth of the swipe right generation. You were the sociologist for Tinder and Bumble. You're now pursuing your second doctorate in clinical psychology, which I love. One wasn't enough. And you're doing relationship and online dating coaching through your company. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bella. I'm really excited to be here with you and your audience today.
Well, good. Well, just Dr. Jess, tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you got to where you are today.
Well, I think I've always been someone who's really been curious about what attracts individuals to other people and the types of relationships that we seek out and form, whether it's familial, romantic, social. And I personally became really fascinated by online dating in the process of doing it myself. When I was getting my doctorate at UCLA in sociology, I was single, 23 years old, and didn't know a soul. And I was studying parent-child relationships and then fell into online dating and said, this is something that's ripe for research. And after that, just began mining as much data as I could, matched with the founder of Tinder. Rather than going on the date, I went to the office and got a job. I was the 25th employee, and it was a fabulous experience that went from there. And I discovered that I really enjoyed learning about the conflicts people have with dating and the issues that they face and trying to understand people at a more granular level to help them find relationships, which led me now to GW, where I'm doing my second doctorate in clinical psychology, and very excited to work in the future with individuals and couples, trying to understand how to be more successful in their partnerships.
I love that story. So instead of matching with the founder of Tinder, you said, hey, I think I'd actually like to work with you. So tell us, what was it like to work with Tinder as employee number 25 at a time that really, from my perspective, revolutionized how we date?
It was certainly revolutionary, and it was incredibly exciting. And I don't think I, at that moment, appreciated the degree to which it was a very unique moment in time. It was incredible. You know, I was one of the oldest people there. I was 28 years old.
You were 28 and one of the oldest people there.
And it was just an incredible time to be working with young people, engineers, marketing people, product people who were really passionate, excited about connecting people in a way where they hadn't been connected historically. And it truly changed the way people date because it brought in entirely new demographics to the online dating scene, namely individuals between the ages of 18 to 24 and individuals above the ages of 55. So it was a really remarkable period of time and an exciting period of time. And what I like to refer to as like the second wave of online dating. I think about the first wave of online dating being in 1995 with the growth of Match and JDate and eHarmony and all these other sites. And then subsequently with the app-based programs like Tinder, Bumble, et cetera. Thinking about that really as a second wave. And then I think we're all very excited to see what the third wave will be. And I think that will largely be centered around AI.
Oh my gosh. What do you think is coming with regards to AI? I think it's so fascinating to think about where dating is going to go, where it's already going in the next 1, 2, and 5 years.
Well, I think that it will be interesting to see how AI is harnessed. I think that AI is already, and I know for a fact that AI has already been being utilized by many of these apps to help people generally. So for example, they are able to tell you what your best photo is. They're able to help really curate potential matches by presenting you with individuals who are similar to people that you'd already swipe right on. So that's already happening. A lot of apps are now introducing chatbots to help assist with the process of connecting with individuals. There are so many different ways that AI could, you know, come about. I think the real interesting way would be to consider and to think about, like, what happens when we're communicating with chatbots generally, and the degree to which there's connection between the authentic self, the person who's actually behind the screen, versus the chatbot, and the degree to which there's a lot of or very little synchronicity between those two personas. So I think those are interesting things to consider generally. I mean, from a self-presentational perspective, we're not always just presenting ourselves, but the person who we aspire to be, as well as the person whom we believe other people would expect us to be. And that's a, you know, a longstanding sociological theory posited by, you know, Irving Goffman in, you know, the 1950s. But I think in online dating context, it becomes especially relevant. And in the context of AI serving as a chatbot, it becomes particularly interesting if we are thinking about how are, you know, these bots being trained to understand what is the aspirational self, what is the actual self, and what is the self that other people desire us to be. So there are many important questions coming about in this industry that I think have real consequences for how individuals might connect moving forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And what do you think, you know, as one of the OG people in dating apps, I've often wondered why the apps, to the point of authenticity, right? We have six spaces to, you know, we've got six slots for photos. We've got 200 characters, basically a tweet and a half to talk about ourselves. Now, but to when you really feel like you know somebody is historically, maybe when you connect on the phone or when you connect in person, then enter COVID, we all go to Zoom and video. Why do you think the apps aren't embracing more authenticity, like taping a little video clip of yourself so that people really can see what the, you know, 3D-ish version of you looks like?
Well, I don't think it's an issue of the apps being averse to it. I think it's an issue as it relates to the consumer. I think that there's so much pressure and labor associated with just selecting a static image of yourself.
For sure. Super stressful.
Very, very. I mean, I've talked to countless people about how stressful it is. And I think that the static image isn't intimidating enough. The idea of trying to create a video about yourself, whether it's 30 seconds or 3 minutes, is, you know, incredibly daunting for an individual. So I don't think it's an app reluctance or a commercial issue. I think it's a market-based consumer problem. And I think that individuals don't necessarily believe that they present as well within a digital format as they do within an in-person format. And that may or may not be consistent with reality, but it's what people feel. And there's a lot of anxiety around it.
No, I think you're so right. I mean, as part of what we've done forever at Smart Dating Academy is either helping people. We had a studio for many, many years, taking professional photos of people to make sure that they're putting their best foot forward, but also their most authentic foot forward. But you're right. I mean, that whole process in and of itself was daunting for people. What do I wear? You know, what looks like me? Is this really me? And to think about actually recording a video, we played around with it for a while with some of our clients. It's like, okay, just tell me about yourself in 30 seconds. And they're like, oh my God, what do you mean? Tell me what? Like, what do I say? How do I? And so I realized early on that, to your point, that's not an easy thing to do. And it's daunting enough to put said six photos up, but then a video feels super intimidating.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So with all of your experience, if we dig back into the dating apps, are there things that you noted that people, you know, we're doing where you would say, hey, you know what, you should actually be doing this to either optimize your profile or optimize the way the algorithms are preferencing it?
Too many things to count, Bella. I mean, I think fundamentally,
I love it.
I think at the end of the day, people are uncertain about what they believe constitutes attractiveness, and we all approach this from our own individual lens. So we have a general perception of like what is attractive, you know, in a more fundamental and universal sense. Like we understand what advertising looks like. A Calvin Klein model is, you know, prototypical. But what is perceived to be attractive in this Calvin Klein ad is not translatable to an online dating photo. If you see somebody, you know, wearing, you know, a very tailored outfit, or, you know, no outfit at all virtually and looking aloof.
Their briefs with an 8-pack.
Precisely. This person does not seem approachable or attainable. They come off as aloof and not accessible. So while they may seem, you know, attractive, it's not somebody who you necessarily would like to connect with or connect with in a way that's more robust. So I think that people have a skewed version of what is attractive in the context of potential romantic partnership connection. And so that's, you know, an initial barrier for people. And then people are not often, you know, your academy's idea of having a studio where people can come in to take photos is a wonderful idea, because, you know, they're people like yourself who are thoughtful, are thinking about it, talking with them about it, and considering how to push people forward in a way that would make them their most authentic and attractive selves to a prospective partner. But, you know, most people are pulling from photos that they've taken, you know, on vacation, at a baseball game, you know, out with friends on a Saturday night, or at a birthday party. And these photos don't necessarily lend themselves well to creating a narrative about who the person is. And that ideally, you know, photos are supposed to be a narrative and tell you something about the person that is meaningful and a source of potential connection. And so I think that the photos that people take often fail to do that, which is a huge problem. And moreover, I think that people's own perceptions of what's being done more widely really influence the photo selection generally. So people have an understanding, you know, men understand that, you know, people take photos of themselves in front of cars or at the gym, or, you know, women understand that people take photos of themselves, you know, at a beach, or like all of these other, you know, tropes that are, you know, largely being applied in the public sphere, you know, are then being looked at negatively by people because they're thinking to themselves, okay, well, this person is arrogant for posting themselves at the gym, not creative, you know, is this actually something they do? You know, there are so many different ways to approach it. And in reality, you know, maybe somebody actually does like their car. Maybe somebody actually does go to the gym. But the way it's being framed is not necessarily telling the story or telling who they are to someone else in a very meaningful way.
No, I completely agree with you. You know, women often complain about, you know, why are these guys all holding up dead fish in their photos or hunted animals? You know, the car selfie was the other one that just mystified me. Like, are we, you know, pulled up at a stoplight, just kind of pull down the mirror and say, I'm feeling myself right now, snap a selfie. Like, and so people do. And I think that there is like, wow, everybody's got pictures of dead fish or of themselves at the gym. So, wow, me too. Maybe I should do this. And the fact of the matter is, if you're not getting the results that you want out of dating, then it's time to ask yourself, should I be doing something different, right? To your point, what we typically advise people to do is there's so much pressure to tell your life story in 6 photos. I'm like, listen, what we're going to recommend is that you look warm, you look trustworthy, you look approachable, you're smiling, you're looking right at the camera, your photos are high resolution, they're not full of shadows, and the photos are of you and only you. And you know what? If you're looking for somebody who can play in your stepped up world, present your stepped up image. You don't want to look schlumpy and dumpy. Most importantly, just pulling from a repository of cell phone photos that we all have. It's like, have someone take good photos of you.
Absolutely. Wholeheartedly agree.
Right. And so I think that, look at this, you know, like Dr. Jess is saying, smart daters, like you're thinking, you want to think about like, okay, this is advertising, but you want to look approachable. You want to put your best foot forward in these photos, right? You don't just want to pick the photos that are sitting around in your cell phone. Really think about who you are and what you want to present. And on that front, so many of you will come to me and say, you know what? I don't have that many hobbies that are photographable. Like, I'm a reader. I like being in bookshops, right? Don't put an inordinate amount of pressure on yourself to have five different things that you love doing, right? If you went on a mountain hike once, but you're not a hiker, you don't have to put that photo in there. Just put photos up that you're proud of that look like the best version of you, and have someone else give you advice on which photos look best, right? Because I think the research shows pretty standardly that we don't pick the best photos of ourselves.
Most individuals do not select the best photos of themselves. No, that is absolutely true.
I know this for a fact. If I look at my own photos, and I don't like getting photos taken, so I completely empathize with all of you out there that don't like it. And I know it's like we all look for certain tics and things that we don't like about ourselves, and we hyperfixate on those. So if I look at the photo I like best of myself, chances are if I show it to four of my friends, they're not going to pick that same photo.
No, and that's a good thing for the apps, because at least Tinder for a very long time would allow people to have the chance to have the photos be curated by them in terms of order, because they used AI to be able to help people know what was performing best.
And let me ask you this. How were they doing that? They're looking at six photos. Was AI looking at the length of time that somebody spent on one photo, or how are the apps and AI discerning, as far as you know, what our best performing photos are?
Well, unfortunately, I can't reveal the secret sauce, but
the recipe for Coke, you can't give it to us?
Unfortunately, no, absolutely not.
Okay, but there's something in the fact that just trust, if the apps tell you X, they know what they're talking about. They're looking for something.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, good, good, good. That's super interesting. Well, tell us, you were telling me that you're obviously, you know, very involved and have been involved in dating, but you're also passionate about relationship coaching. Let's talk about what you're doing there.
Well, I enjoy working with people who are struggling to find something. I think it's really one of the most fundamental tasks we have as individuals is relationship formation. And it's really hard to mentalize and put yourself in the shoes of someone else. That's, I think, one of the biggest challenges we face daily, whether it's in our romantic lives, our work lives, our familial lives. It's really hard to step outside of ourselves. And I think that the only way to have a successful long-term relationship in any context is the capacity to step outside of yourself and to consider the perspective of others and what's informing that and what is it going on, what's going on dynamically between them and you and yourself at that point, which is driving what's being brought up for you in a way that's really activating. And so I really try to work with people to analyze, you know, what has been their pattern historically, like what is going on for them relationally that's in ways inhibiting their ability to move forward in a meaningful way.
Wow. Can you tell us a story about that? I'm very fascinated. It's like the ability to step outside of yourself and to relate not only to yourself, but to someone else. I think that's something that we can all learn to do better.
Well, I think that people have their own perceptions of why people are behaving in the manner in which they're behaving. And they're informed by our own perspective. And how we approach relationships rather than thinking about the way another individual approaches relationships. So I was working with somebody for quite a lengthy period of time who was dating someone, and they were new in a relationship or relatively new in a relationship. And the individual had invited them to spend time together a week before a holiday weekend. And they spent a whole stretch of time together. But then during the holiday weekend, the person said that they just wanted to spend time with their friends and didn't pick up their phone for a whole day, essentially, and ignored the person's phone calls. Like
after they'd been together for a week.
A stretch of time. And had explained that they had planned to spend the time with their friends. And the person was like horribly offended that this person didn't want to include them in their plans, that this person, you know, said that they didn't, you know, pick up the phone or respond to their text messages the whole day. And then, you know, heard from them basically 12 hours later and basically said, you know, this person doesn't prioritize me. If they really cared about me, they would have included me. you know, this is not how I want to be treated. I deserve to be with somebody who, you know, wants to spend, you know, all of their time with me and include me in their life in a really meaningful way. And in all due candor, that's just not a realistic expectation in a relatively new relationship. I think that helping this individual to step back and realize that there might be things going on for this person related to when and how they would like to integrate somebody into their life that have absolutely nothing to do with you personally and have everything to do with them, whether it's how they have approached how their friends perceive a former partner, whether or not it's about what, you know, friends or family events mean for them and what it means to bring someone to these events. You know, myriad issues could be at play here in terms of integrating somebody into their life in a meaningful way. And that there needs to be adequate agreement between people regarding this. And for this individual, obviously, maybe she prioritizes spending time with people initially and meeting their friends more quickly. But there needs to be a negotiation and a conversation about it. And she did not have the capacity to think about this in a way that was more holistic until we talked about it in a more meaningful way. She was ready to break up with him, end it right then and there. But after talking about it and thinking about what the possibilities were, you know, I encouraged her to have a conversation where she discussed it with this person and, you know, told them, you know, her perspective and asked them about their perspective. Because it's only through understanding that we, you know, move forward. You know, I like to joke around that I have, you know, currently two PhDs, one in my husband and one in sociology, and, you know, I have a third doctorate. But like, I think that that's really the goal of, in any relationship, is to like get a doctorate in your spouse or your partner. Like, it's really about trying to understand fundamentally who they are and how they operate and how you operate with them. And you know, often I think we become upset and incensed with somebody when we're with them and dating them or married to them, because we just see their actions and we don't understand the motivations underlying them. And I think that if you understand the motivations underlying them, it might still be incensing. Don't get me wrong. You may still be angry about it, but at least you have that perspective and the capacity to understand the motivations.
You're right. I mean, we all wear a certain set of lenses based on our experiences, and we're going to look at somebody's actions with through the lenses that we wear. And one of the things we do, you know, similar, maybe just differently phrased, I tell my clients, like, okay, let's tell yourself a different story. Let's assume positive intent. Let's think of three other reasons they might not have included you right away. Right? Let's just step out of the bad story. And immediately you can sense that their nervous system calms down a little bit. Like, what are three other truths that there could be? And usually the truth is somewhere in between. And what that has done is it helps facilitate a much more placid conversation. Once they sort of bring, it's not like, why did you abandon me? You left me alone. Like, don't you know? The person's like, wait a second. You know, last time, and I've actually had this happen recently where a woman felt like, oh my gosh, like I want to be included in the Super Bowl celebration with this guy's his friends. And when they actually talked about it and she hadn't gotten the invite, he said, you know, what's interesting is everybody has warned me that I jump into things so quickly. And when I get into relationships, I abandon my friends. So what I'm trying to do is be more mindful of spending time with both. And I'm so glad you brought this up. Would you like to go to the Super Bowl celebration with me?
What a great resolution.
Right. And so it's about assume positive intent, listeners, and then use your voice. Ask about the thing that you're unsure about before you make assumptions.
Yes, I think that people often don't call things to question, Bella, in all aspects of a relationship. And I think therein lies the issue, because it leads to confusion, resentment, and a lack of understanding between people. But I think that most people are afraid to question, to find out what actually is going on, because that can be even more disruptive than what's happening in front of them.
Yeah. Are there any tips that you can give us when we feel ourselves kind of losing our SH1T about something? Like, is there a way you can step out of yourself at that moment? Like, I always say, wait, okay, if you're feeling that emotion rise, like, take a deep breath and step outside of yourself. Are there any things, you know, that you can, you know, any tips or tricks or tools that you use to help people step out of themselves?
Get rid of your phone and go for a walk. By yourself. Be by yourself. Be alone with your thoughts. Get rid of the phone. Get rid of all forms of like connection and just go for a walk. Like if it's cold outside and you live in Chicago, like where you are, you know, walk down your hallway in your house, like put your phone upstairs or put your phone in a room, lock your door and just walk up and down. Or if you're in a place that's nicer out, go outside for a walk and just be alone with yourself, your thoughts, no phones, just yourself.
And walking is key, right? Because I think that there's something about consistent, I call it robotic motion for me. Sometimes I get my best ideas when I'm on a treadmill or when I'm on an elliptical, like where it's just like, I'm not thinking about anything else. There might be music, but it's suddenly like, oh my gosh, I got to stop and write that down. So there's something about that motion that can bring about clarity.
Yeah, I think it's about motion. I think it's also just about just having something that's being performed, but you don't have to do anything. Like it's inertia, you know, there's inertia there. And then it just kind of allows this free process to happen.
Awesome. And do you advocate, Dr. Jess, that if somebody knows, like, hey, I might be anxious if I don't hear from you for 12 hours, is that okay to do in the beginning of a relationship?
Well, I guess what constitutes the beginning of a relationship? I mean, I think that context is key.
Yes.
And it matters. And it's a question of what is the context happening? Like, and, you know, if you understand that people, you know, it's a 4th of July weekend and people are at a lake and, you know, there might be limited reception, you know, it might be reasonable that you don't hear from somebody for 12 hours. Or like, let's say, you know, you're dating someone and, you know, you text them at 8 a.m. and then you don't hear from to 8 p.m. They could have been very busy working. You know, and I think it's about, as you said, you know, there's positive intention and asking about and thinking about and considering other possibilities. And just because you don't text someone back doesn't necessarily mean immediately that you're not a priority. Obviously, we want to be responded to in a timely manner. And not responding to somebody in a timely manner is certainly indicative of a potential lack of interest. But assuming that because it took somebody, you know, one day an hour to respond to you, and another day 12 hours to respond to you, is not necessarily dispositive in terms of saying, oh, this person likes me today and tomorrow they're angry with me. It's just perhaps this person had a free time today or had a meeting or was on an airplane. You know, there are so many different things and people are just so busy. You know, there are relatively few people I will respond to immediately in my life. But you know, I don't assume that one day if my husband doesn't respond to me for 3 hours that, you know, he's mad at me. I assume that he's busy in meetings.
This is part of your PhD that you have in your husband.
I do. It was the second chapter of my dissertation. Exactly.
And did you guys meet online? You have to tell us.
We did, of course. We matched on Tinder, JSwipe and Hinge all on the same day. We matched on Tinder and talked on Tinder first. But yeah.
Wait a second. Okay. You matched on Tinder, JSwipe, and Hinge on the same day on three apps.
He had just moved to Los Angeles, so it was sort of kismet in that way.
That's hugely kismet. That's like that is a sign from every god in the universe. Three apps.
Yeah. Yes. God and algorithms wanted us together, is what I tell people.
Oh my gosh. So tell me who made the first move after three matches where you're like, okay, 1, 2, 3, how did that happen?
He did actually. He asked me how I knew a mutual friend.
Right. He's like, hey, good to see you on three different apps. Looks like this is faded.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Awesome. And how many apps do you recommend that people are on at the same time? Or do you think it depends?
Well, I think I think that from the data, it seems like the average number of people are on 3 or 4 apps at a given time. And I think that's a great approach. It's a portfolio approach. You know, people are on Tinder. People are on, you know, an affinity app related to like ethnicity or religion. People are on, you know, general apps like, you know, Bumble and Hinge and OkCupid. So I think it's good to be on 3 or 4 different apps and to, you know, think about what you're looking for, what you want. And there are all different ways of potentially presenting yourself. And I think that's important. So I'd say 3 or 4 apps at a given time can be really positive.
Awesome. You know, are there any gems that you'd like to leave our listeners with that I may not have asked you about?
I think that, you know, one thing I'd like to leave listeners with is to really, and I think this comes out, is really just getting outside of themselves, whether it's, you know, you're in the relationship or out of the relationship. You know, I think that often when you're dating online, you are activated by things that you don't know. There's a lack of information. So we allow ourselves to fill this vacuum with our doubts and our insecurities. But I think that by stepping outside of yourself in the process of dating and matching, it is much more effective in that vein as well.
That's awesome. You're right. And that comes back down to some extent. It's like, tell yourself the better story, right? Don't tell yourself don't fill your mind and the vacuum with all of the things that might not be going right. It's like, just move on. We tell people, play the numbers game, right? Don't hyperfixate on any one person. You're not going to know that somebody's your husband. Well, maybe except for you, because you matched on 3 apps on the same day. But the average bear isn't going to know by 6 photos and 200 characters if someone is their partner or not. It's like, just give it some time to breathe.
Well, it took us 4 years to get married. So I clearly was not, you know, 3 dating apps matching. But no, but I mean, it does take time to know that this person is the right person for you. I think that it's, you know, while it's not, you know, culturally consistent historically, you know, to wait as long as we do to partner in terms of like relationship duration prior to marriage, you know, there is value in being thoughtful about who you choose and like figuring that out over time, because you do learn and more is revealed over time. So I think being patient with the process, while frustrating in the moment and inherently, is just part and parcel of the game.
And I'm a big believer in the dating apps, and I assume you are too.
Oh yes, I'm a huge advocate. I understand that there are plenty of people who poo-poo the apps, but I view it as the poo-pooing of dating as an institution, with dating apps being the proxy or representative of dating.
Yes. I mean, I tell our clients all the time, like, thank goodness for the apps. If this was 1985, how would you be meeting people, right? Thank goodness for the fact that the internet and dating online and on the apps exists, because you now have access to more people than you ever would have at any point in history. Of course, are there some downsides to that? But let's look at the upsides that, you know, the dating world is your giant oyster. So I'm glad that you and I are on the same page about the dating apps. Easy? No. Effective? Absolutely, if you have the right lens.
For sure.
Well, awesome. Dr. Jess, if people want more of you, where can they find you?
www.drjesscarboneau.com is where you can find me, on my website, and then Dr. Jess Carboneau on Instagram.
Thank you so much. And smart daters, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I do. And I hope that you dust off some of your apps, get some new photos, get rid of the dead fish, the car selfies, the gym selfies, and step yourself up and do something good for your dating apps. And you know what? Do something really nice for yourself today, just for having listened to this conversation. So until our next episode, I bid you farewell. And Dr. Jess, thank you again for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bella.
Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love. Follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.